I'd like to welcome the head of distilling at Ardbeg and Glenmorangie, Dr. Bill Lumsden, and Fran Schurer, amongst a bit of whisky royalty here. Firstly, Bill, what brings you to Australia?
Yeah, I'm here in Asia for 2 weeks. I come out a couple of times a year, coinciding the launch of various products. So it's the launch of Glenmorangie's 6th in the private edition to sale. So that's the primary reason I'm here.
Well, what's the output of that? What's actual, how much is produced?
Yeah, it was fairly limited, so about 4,500 cases globally, mm-hmm. of which I guess a fairly small amount, maybe about 700 cases, has come to Asia.
So how long have you worked for Glenmorangie?
This is actually my 20th year. On the 20th of February this year, I always remember the date because my dad's birthday was when I started with Glenmore, so 20 years with Glenmorangie.
What position did you start in?
I started off as distillery manager at the Glenmorangie Distillery, which was kind of a dream job for me because it was Glenmorangie that started it all for me. It was the first whisky, malt whisky I ever tasted. Now, a sense of destiny.
Now, Franz, how did you meet Bill?
I don't know, actually. Over whisky, for sure. But how? Do you remember?
Yeah, at Canberra, the 2003 Whisky Convention
was the first time
we met. But our friendship has been a bit of a slow burn. And once we eventually realised we're like-minded in many ways, it kind of...
We had the same sense of humour, I think.
And same sense of appreciation of a lot of things. Yeah.
Bill, I'm really, really happy with the fact that Bill is an entity in whisky. And everyone sort of kowtows to what he does, and he needs time off. And the time off he gets by being off-leash from his company, and we spend time together. It's wonderful. Yeah. It's really good.
So what is it, your shared love of whisky? What is the shared love between the two of you as far as that's
I think concerned? We both enjoy a dram, we both enjoy a non-PC joke, we both enjoy a beer, we both enjoy good wine, and we both enjoy good food. So that's what we've done. We've eaten at great places. We've drunk some great stuff. He finds occasionally a spirit that I didn't even know exists. And I occasionally find a wine he doesn't know it exists. So it sort of works.
Now, Bill, earlier on you talked about a particular drink that turned your destiny. Can you talk a bit about that just for our listeners?
Yeah, it was, you know, as a Scotsman, of course, whisky is our national drink, and I dabbled once or twice with blended scotch. I remember very clearly the first time I seriously drunk whisky, and it was an old, nice old Scottish brand, a blended scotch called Stewart's Cream of the Barley. But I think I was too young at the time to appreciate it, and I didn't go back to it till I was 24 and tasted single malt scotch for the first time, and I marvelled at how approachable and soft and interesting it was to drink, and that pretty much got me hooked.
So where did you go from there? So you had that almost like a catharsis. Where did you, what was the next step after that?
Yeah, when I tasted that, and it was Glenmorangie 10-year-old that I tried, and then, you know, I wasn't wealthy then, still haven't, but, you know, I used to use my student grant, and I went to a particular bar in Edinburgh called the Jolly Judge, a pub called the Jolly Judge, and once a week I would try different malt whiskies and got into the category. And it was while I was doing my PhD, and that pretty much made me decide that my destiny lay in the Scotch whisky industry. So that's how it all started.
That's actually a question that interests me. You did also either an apprenticeship or learned about brewing beer, didn't you?
At that time, Heriot Watt was primarily, within the Department of Biological Sciences, they had a very famous brewing school. Mm-hmm. It's now the Department of Brewing and Distilling. Yeah. So that got me interested in brewing beer, in malting barley, and also in whisky.
Because I remember the first whisky you made from a really dark porter. Yeah. You used a really dark beer to start your whisky.
Yeah.
And I thought, what is happening here? Yeah. It's just divine.
Yeah.
I do remember that.
Yeah. That was the inspiration for Signet, was my love of dark beer.
So what was your friends? Now talking about your first influence in whisky, because I don't know this myself, so what was the turning point for you? Where was your interest sparked?
I think realizing that whiskey is not just a drink for old men, I think that was the turning point. I suddenly realized this is amazing. This is something that has complexity, has body, has texture, and it's not every single bottle. I think that's, I have to say that this is when the turning point came to, I used to drink an occasional blend, and now I drink purely single malts. And for the people who don't necessarily understand the difference, Bill can probably do it better than me, but the fundamental difference between a blender and a master distiller is that the blender will try year after year to recreate the company's idea of a dram. So a Johnnie Walker Red is a Johnnie Walker Red now in 1950, in 1930, in 1910, whereas Glenmorangie Original is different every year. Mm. It never is quite the same. Mm. Every single malt is an experience. That's why I like them. I like adventure. Am I sort of right?
You're absolutely right, Franz. And that's what intrigued me about single malt. There was two things. There was all of the history and the heritage, and you know, just the sheer love that goes into making the product, because it takes such a long time.
Can we talk about the heritage a bit there? Yeah. Because, I mean, that must be an amazing responsibility for you in your position. I mean, how do you bear that responsibility? I mean,
well, the thing is that, you know, I certainly have not changed the Glenmorangie house style, and I don't think too many people would thank me for doing that. So I've taken that and tried to build on it a little bit. I really have two facets to my job. I have maintaining the integrity and quality of the core range, but I have experimentation and trying to find new flavours, try different barrels, things like that.
We talked earlier about the house style of Glenmorangie. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. The house style of Glenmorangie is, first of all, it's very accessible, because, you know, a lot of single malts are up there, very bold in terms of their flavour, and can be a little bit challenging.
Yeah.
Glenmorangie is extremely accessible. It's soft, creamy texture. It has a sweet flavour. It has incredible complexity in terms of the fruity and floral notes, and it has this lovely sweetness from the barrels. So that's the Glenmorangie house style to me.
Mm. Now, you talked about earlier about a batch, Franz, you talked about earlier about a very special almost a whiskey that you had earlier. I mean, can you tell us a bit about that? I mean, there was something you'd experienced earlier in a special night that you'd had. You had a tasting?
Unfortunately, the head distiller at Artbeg, Bill wasn't there at the time, let me loose in the Dunwich warehouse. And we basically tried barrel after barrel after barrel after barrel, and I found one I really, really liked. I mean, not just liked, I mean, really, really liked. And I managed to get some there and then Bill sent me some.
Mm.
And Bill sent me some again. So eventually I did something at Claude's when Chewy Le Luck was there, just after Tim Puckpoy gave it over to Chewy Le Luck. And it was called the Ultimate Artbeg Dinner. We opened some incredible whiskies. Basically, whatever we can get hold of. I don't think you could actually assemble them again.
No, that was like a dream tasting. I mean, you showed me what was in
so
there.
So what are we talking about? What was on display that evening?
The one that Franz is talking about was an experimental whiskey using very unusual French oak casks, which I have to say I didn't quite know at that time what I was going to do with it, but it turned out to be the heart of Artbeg Corrie Vrekken. And again, that's one of the things I love about the whiskey industry, that you can do bits and pieces like that and someone will appreciate it. And Franz especially loved that particular whiskey.
Yeah, I adored it. Jane, do you remember some of the whiskies that we served on the Ultimate? It was the 1965.
We had the Artbeg Provenance.
Provenance, yeah.
1977 Artbeg.
Of course,
1978 Artbeg.
Correct. Mm.
And
what else? There was one more.
There was the Franz Schurer cask.
Yeah, the one we just talked
red
about.
Wine cask.
There was one more. It later became one of the two whiskies in that gun case.
Oh, yeah. So that'd be a 1974.
I think that's what it was,
because
yeah.
Because the double barrel, which was one of these curious projects, I have to say, I chose the whiskey for it.
Yeah.
And there was four pairs of casks from 1974 went into that. And, you know, some of them were just unbelievably good.
Yeah. I remember the whiskies. I don't really remember the rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was nice. There was a diary, there was a pen, there was things, but it was about the whiskies.
Yeah, the double-barreled gun case was a curious type of a thing. Beautiful handmade leather case.
Yeah.
Two bottles, a pair from 1974, some silver cups, a fancy
pen,
right,
yeah.
and all that jazz. But, you know, from my perspective as a distiller, that was all superfluous. It's all
did you
about
ever buy
whiskey.
One, Shane?
I didn't know.
No. We only got two in Australia.
I think that would probably be right, two or three.
Yeah.
We talked earlier about when you became head distiller. I mean, you had almost the freedom to go back and look at your museum stocks and look at that. Yeah. Can you talk a bit about that? Because, I mean, that must have been incredible to have that liberty.
Ardbeg is a very particular brand of Scotch whisky, and at the time when we bought it, I did not fully understand the cult following it had. And I'm ashamed to admit the very first time I ever tasted Ardbeg was 1997 when we bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out to Islay, which I knew I'd been out in Islay in my Diageo days many times. And I met with the famous whisky writer Jim Murray, who I knew was always a big fan, and he's got this famous phrase, unquestionably the greatest distillery on earth. If perfection on the palate exists, this is it. And I paid Jim lip service, I have to say. But the very first Ardbeg I tasted was at the Machri Hotel in Islay, and it was a 1978 bottled by Gordon and MacPhail. Because the distillery-owned bottlings were so rare and so scarce because most of the output went into blending. But I remember being blown away by this, that it managed to marry the incredible intensity of the peat smoke with lots and lots of complexity, and that pretty much got me hooked on Ardbeg.
So where like, what museum stocks do you hold now?
In terms of museum stocks, if you're meaning in cask, our stock profile is unusual because the distillery was sadly closed between 1981 and 1989, so there's a big hole in the stock profile.
What happened there? What was that?
Well, the previous owners decided they didn't need the stock for their blends for whatever reason. Which, it is what it is. I know that we get comments from people, it would be better if it was X, Y, or Z. You know, we've done, honestly, our very best to spread out the stocks that we inherited. And of course, since we bought the distillery in 1997, we've built the production up. And the distillery goes flat out now. So the good news is for Ardbeg lovers that the whisky will always be available and in slightly bigger volumes.
I remember the first time I was in Scotland, I wanted some Ardbeg, and everyone said, sorry, can't get it.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem an unreasonable request. And you just couldn't get it.
Where do you see the future of how you direct the company as far as head distiller, and what's your vision?
Yeah, my vision is, again, I can probably split this into three things. Firstly, the core ranges of both Glenmorangie and Ardbeg will continue to exist, and I'll continue to do my best to make sure they're of the quality people know and expect. The second thing is that I will introduce other expressions of it using different barrel types. And the third thing is that I will innovate and do various experiments. And I've got a lot of really wacky things going on at the moment at both distilleries.
Now, we had an Australian Scotch earlier, Franz, and Bill. What's your opinion of what we had earlier? I mean, where are we standing as far as Australian Scotch?
Well, you're asking the wrong person because I basically hate Australian Scotches. With the exception of Tim Duckett's stuff. I think he does really, really nice stuff. What we had tonight the Smith is a really, really good drink.
Mm.
But to me, it's brandy-esque, not whiskey-esque.
Mm.
It's a great drink. I think the major problem with Australian whiskies is the fact that we are not old enough.
Mm.
We don't have 100 years to go back to. We don't have the expertise, nor the wood, nor the money tied up in stocks that are 10, 12, 15, 20, 25 year old. So in 30 years' time, I reckon we're there, not now.
How do we influence that, Bill? How do we change that?
Well, again, there's a couple of things to this, and I agree with what Franz is saying. I'm not as familiar with all the Australian brands as Franz is, but to me...
No, go on, keep yourself
in. To me, some of them are a little bit too young, and the climate in Australia is not on the side of a long, slow maturation. And, I mean... To try and illustrate that, in terms of the mighty Japanese whiskies, my favourite, without question, is Yuichi, which is distilled and matured on the island of Hokkaido, which is in the north part of Japan, where it's much colder and damper. And these conditions help develop fragrance and complexity. And to me, at the moment, that's the one thing that's slightly missing in Australian whiskey. Is, I mean, it's great. There's a lot of influence from the wood here. This whiskey we're drinking, the Smith's, as Fran said, he said it was cognac-like because there's so much influence from the wood, and I think it's a French oak barrel. But it needs a long, slow maturation in cool conditions, would be my suggestion as to how Aussie whiskey can maybe start to become a bit more complex.
I was talking a bit earlier about Australian whiskey, so where do you think that's at, Bill? As far as your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a young industry in terms of the length of time been doing it. And I've tried quite a few Australian whiskies in my time. And to me, there's a kind of theme through them all is that, you know, there's a youthfulness in there, obviously. And I don't think the climate here is quite right. And my suggestion would be that if we can... I don't know.
I have Pinot Noir.
The whole thing about Scotch to me is, which gives it its complexity and its fragrance, is that we mature for a long time in very cold, damp warehouses. And to me, that's the secret of making really great whiskey. And I think I maybe mentioned earlier about my favourite Japanese whiskey, Yuichi. And I think it's better than Karuzawa and Chichibu and Yamazaki and Hakushu for that reason, that has lots of complexity about it. So I think the Australian whiskey industry will get there, but maybe need to think about where it's matured.
Now, your thoughts, Franz?
I will say something here, because I honestly do not believe that the Australian whiskey industry can actually achieve a good Scotch. I don't think so.
But can I just ask, Bill's saying it's all about maturation. Isn't our whiskey being matured in our coldest climate in Tasmania? Isn't that the most of our...
Yeah, it gets very hot.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And Scotland never does.
No.
Never get very hot there, okay.
See, that brings me back to what I was saying. I don't believe that we will ever do a rival whiskey to a Scottish whiskey.
What about...
However, we will come to be able to develop an Australian style of whiskey. Tim Duckett is the best example. What he's done, he's broken all the rules. He's one of those guys who knows the rules, so he knows how to break them. And he's taken whiskey and he basically cooks them. Mm-hmm. He puts them in a shed, in the hottest part of the shed. He has huge temperature fluctuations, and then he matures them in an open, big vat where he basically covers them loosely with a piece of wood that doesn't quite fit, so all the volatiles can escape. And once a month or so, he goes and tries it. And eventually, all the volatiles have blown off, and you end up with a beautiful whiskey. Now, there is one other aspect. The more humid, this is something it's hard to get your head around, but the more humidity there is in the air, the more the angel share, the more the alcohol evaporates and the water molecules get replaced on a regular basis. The drier it is, the less the alcohol evaporates and the more the water evaporates. It's totally contrary to what you think. What actually happens is in Scotland, the alcohol is going down, water content is going up.
That makes sense.
In cognac, no, it doesn't. In cognac, it's the opposite. The actual alcohol content goes up, the water content goes down.
Why doesn't it
in Australia, sense? It's exactly the same thing.
That's cognac.
You have contents going up. The new make of Tim Duckett is somewhere about 65%. By the time he bottles it, 77%.
Yeah. Okay? That would never happen in
Scotland. It could not happen
never
in Scotland.
In Scotland.
Because no, where you've got high humidity, your moisture replaces your alcohol.
It's not that easy. Normally, if you have water and you got whiskey, what evaporates first, regardless?
Alcohol.
Correct. So why the hell does it not happen in Scotland?
It does. What you're saying is you end up with low alcohol in Scotland and high alcohol in France.
No, the alcohol doesn't evaporate quicker in the hot climates. The opposite. You
okay,
go to Scotland.
Right. Now it is contrary.
Right?
Because
the contrary.
I thought you were saying the water goes in to the wood and the alcohol goes out, so you end up with lower alcohol.
Exactly.
In Scotland.
The barrel breathes, even although the liquid doesn't physically leak out.
No. But
the vapours can actually go in through the wood.
It's not impermeable.
And the same thing is happening in Australia, and until the people realise here that we do not have an angel share.
So what are you saying? That the alcohol content ends up lower in Scotland and higher in
Correct.
France? Yeah, that makes sense, because you've got water replacing the alcohol in Scotland and you haven't got it replacing the alcohol in France, because France is dry.
Yeah, same here, but the alcohol actually goes up.
It
concentrates the alcohol.
Because you've got less liquid going in.
I know it's scientifically quite okay.
It makes perfect sense.
But people don't understand it.
Well, it's logical.
Okay. Logical.
In Scotland, where it's high humidity, you've got water going in and alcohol going out. In France, where it's dry, you've got alcohol going out and nothing replaces it, so you end up with a concentrated product. That's why you dry things in the Mediterranean Sea.
That's why we will never make a scotch in Tasmania.
It's
fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what about North America? North America's hot, even in the mountains. They
totally
have hot
different.
Summers.
Totally
so
different.
Can we make a bourbon? Can we make a Tennessee-style whiskey? Can we make American-style whiskey?
There's no reason why we couldn't make a bourbon.
Is that what we should be aiming for?
There's no reason why we couldn't, and we do. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And is that what we should be aiming for? Is that more realistic?
Well,
not a Scottish-style whiskey, but an American-style.
I have no problems with something like Tim Duckett's idea of making an Australian whiskey. It's beautiful.
But is it a more American-style than Scottish?
No, it's not. It's still using second-hand barrels. It's not using first fill. It's using second fill.
Which is the key to bourbon or Tennessee whiskey. Really
is first fill.
It's first fill. The
Correct.
New charcoal.
So they're getting a lot of wood in there.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Very different and much more sweet. The sweetness in bourbon...
Sweetness comes out of the wood, out of the
yes,
sap,
does.
I guess,
yeah.
virtually.
Yeah.
Does it?
Yeah.
It's the lignin and lactone degradation products that lead to other compounds. Vanillin and vanillic acid are the key to it, which is lignin.
And they're there in the wood, naturally.
I'm just, again, very boring here, but in terms of the structural components of oak wood, about 50 to 60% of it is... Cellulose, sorry, forgot about that, which is absolutely doesn't interact at all. It does not break down. But then about 25% of it is a component called lignin, and when you toast or char, the lignin breaks down and you, with your spirit, suck it all out. And that's where the main wood extractives come from.
Right. And that's why American whiskey is sweeter than Scottish whiskey.
Basically, yeah, it's not that they add bags of sugar to it.
It gets the sweetness from the wood.
Yeah.
I actually once did the experiments when Dr. Bill took me to America, and we went to the Blue Hill Cooperage, and he's developed a system where he toasts the barrel a considerably shorter time than what they do, and I try the difference. It's very unattractive, but I got a stave of the normal toast and the stave of, of what you did, and I bit into it and I sucked on it.
What dedication, Dan. Yeah.
And I tell you what, one is like industrial caramel, bitter and bloody horrible, and the one you did for the Astar, sweet, just bloody beautiful.
The difference is that our toasting process, which actually takes much longer, is heat rather than naked flame, so it penetrates into the wood. Whereas, to use the quaint technical term for a bourbon barrel, they char the fuck out the inside of it.
To the extent that it almost ignites.
And it's like having a piece of bread.
So are you doing it at a lower temperature for a longer time?
Yeah, absolutely.
And he doesn't just use fire. Or is that classified?
It's very classified.
It's infrared.
Yeah, in the old days, it'd be a small brazier of glowing oak chips. But, you know, it's very inefficient doing it that way.
What you're replicating.
Yeah, yeah. But where now they use electronic infrared probes, where they toast evenly the whole barrel.
But it's about longer time, lower temperature.
Yes, correct.
Which is what you get quite often in certain cheeses when you're not doing major pasteurisation, but when you're... Yeah, I did think about that. There's no bread left, though.
Now, one thing we had today, we had, I noticed a hobby of yours, or a passion of yours, is wine. We had some beautiful 1999 Shiraz Wendry today. Can you talk a bit about your passion for wine?
I absolutely adore wine. I've got a little wine cellar at home. I've got very eclectic tastes in terms of wine, in terms of the origins of the wine and in terms of the grape variety. Although I do have my favourites, I have to say. But what we had today, the A.P. Burke's Wendouri Shiraz, was not like the Aussie Shiraz that a lot of the world imagines. This has an unbelievable complexity. And the first thing I picked up on it on the bouquet, and I know Franz had decanted the wine earlier, was this astonishing aroma of damp tent canvas, which can put a lot of people off. But I thought, I know what this is. I've recognised this tremendous complexity. So, I mean, if you're asking me, Dave, I mean, I don't really have a favourite wine per se, because I like so many different ones. But I have to say, if I'm drinking white, I'm a Chardonnay guy. And to me, white Burgundy is the cloud-capped pinnacle of that style of production. In terms of red, I like Syrah, Shiraz, I like Pinot Noir, I like Cabernet.
We talk a bit about food and whiskey, because in a couple of weeks, Franz is about to do a whiskey dinner at a restaurant in Surry Hills. And can you talk about the synergy between whiskey and food?
Whiskey and food is one of these things which in the Western world is misunderstood. And we would typically drink whiskey before the meal, after the meal, on its own. We wouldn't normally have it with food. And it's not the easiest thing in the world to pair with food. But again, you know, out here in Asia, the range of tastes you have in Asian cuisine is quite staggering. So certain brands do pair quite nicely. Or did you want me to be more specific about that?
Oh, just sort of interesting. I mean, because as far as in Australian taste, I mean, we don't really perceive whiskey as a food match. But, I mean, Franz has been a bit of a pioneer in that respect with our restaurants here. That he's done these whiskey dinners that's opened our minds to that. So what should we be looking for as diners in that respect?
It's very difficult to see what you should be looking for, Dean, because there's such variation in there. But, you know, obviously, you need to find something that's mildly sympathetic to the taste profile. So, for example, our Ardbeg brand, very difficult to pair with food because it's so intense. And smoked fish and cheese, frankly, are the only two things that I would recommend pairing Ardbeg with. Whereas Glenmorangie, depending on which expression it is, that it does pair with a lot of different bits and pieces.
Now, you said Glenmorangie earlier on is a very elegant whiskey. Can you talk a bit about that? Because that's quite interesting. I mean,
Yeah, it's elegant for a number of reasons. You know, tall stills give a very perfumed, very subtle spirit in there. It's a fast maturing spirit. It picks up flavour from the wood very quickly. The fact that we use bourbon barrels gives a range of flavours which I believe beautifully complements the house style. So it's all about these fruity and floral flavours. Whereas if you're using heavily peated malt, clearly you're not going to get that. If you use very heavy sherry casks, you may or may not get a complementary range of flavours. But sherry casks typically give you lots of spices, molasses, brown sugar, dates, raisins, things like that. So it's impossible to answer the question specifically. It just depends on the whiskey in question.
Now, Frank, Glenmorangie still has the tallest stills in Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
Exchange stills.
Now, we're about to head to India.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about, is that the next frontier for whiskey? Or
who wants cheese?
What's
got some more bread coming.
Too. What's happening there?
I have to say, I don't think it's the next frontier, Dane, because it's already a fairly mature and well-established whiskey market. What I think will happen is, Dane, that they will gradually be an increasing number of people that will appreciate that from single malt. From blended scotch to single malt. You're going to get an interesting perspective there, different range of flavours. And I think that will continue, that single malt will blaze a trail in India.
Can you tell us about the existing whisky market in India? Because that's quite intriguing from my point of view. I didn't even know it existed.
There's a massive whisky market in India, but the vast majority of it actually technically is not whisky. Because it's distilled from molasses sugar cane, so it's a rum technically.
But it's
done in a kind of whisky production method. It's done in pot stills and matured in barrels. But within that, you know, ever since the days of the Raj and all that good stuff, there has been an appreciation of whisky in India, so Indian consumers like it. Very curiously to me, they have a leaning towards very smoky whiskies, which is why brands like Johnnie Walker Black Label does so well out there. But, you know, again, I'm not necessarily the best person to answer that question because I haven't been there for such a long time. But the one thing I will say is that if the importation taxes were reduced in India and suddenly the market truly opened up to foreign liquor, the Scotch whisky industry could not possibly support the demand that there would be there.
No chance.
Yeah. So,
you do a lot of travelling in your role at Glenmorangie. Can you tell us about where else you're travelling in the world and what that entails?
It'd be a lot quicker if he tells you where he's not travelling.
I do several PR trips a year, and I always go to the United States at least twice a year, which is our biggest market. Last year I was in the US 6 times, albeit 2 of these were for holiday. I always come to Asia twice a year. I do a bit in Europe. It just depends on, you know, our key strategic markets for Glenmorangie is, number one is United States, number two is Taiwan, number three is the UK. Then it's a collection between France, Germany, Japan, China, just wherever. So, I mean, I don't, unfortunately, choose where I go to. But it's wherever there's demand.
And what's the future of Glenmorangie as a brand? I mean, where do you see that as...
We're never going to be number one in terms of single malt. We're not big enough. We don't aspire towards that, but we just want to keep being the most innovative and keep winning awards.
Well, thank you for your none of your knowledge, your intelligence, your humour today, Bill. But I'll leave the last word to Franz who and Roberta, who have been your hosts today. I mean, anything you'd like to say, Franz, about Bill?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I just want to say...
Taxi for Lumsden.
I'll jump on that one.
I want him back in a week, in 5 weeks, in 10 weeks, in 20 weeks. I want him back more often.
Mm. I'd like to thank Roberta and Franz firstly for the hospitality today. I mean, it's been unparalleled. Mm. And Bill, thank you for your amazing company today and knowledge and, as I said, intelligence about whiskey. And I'm trying to learn as much as I can. Mm. And it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Thank you.